Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, last night's big speech had a good audience. I think it was well received. 85% of the people who viewed it said they approved of it. That is fantastic. And like I said, I think it's a reset in moving us back to the days of old, like the era that my grandparents grew up in. I think that's not a bad thing. But one of the tweets that caught my attention was written by a guy named David Kuznet. He was a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, also for Walter Mondale and Mike Dukakis. He tweeted out, "Every Democratic president from Jimmy Carter to Joe Biden started out with an initiative to restore workers' rights to organize. But Joe Biden is the first to include workers' rights in a joint session speech." And I would argue to this point already, in my view, Joe Biden's already done more for the labor movement than all of the other ones just because he fired Peter Robb on day one. That's a big part of this. But here to share some thoughts on the tweet, on the speech, and maybe where we go from here, I've asked David Kuznet to come talk with us. Like I said, former speechwriter, author, fantastic book that I think is great. Love the work, hate the job. We'll talk about that a little bit too. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So you're, as a former speechwriter, as a guy who, this is your deal, take it apart for me. What'd you think?
Well, I thought it was a great speech. And I think the real test of a speech isn't just if, you know, if it's a good speech in the abstract, but if it's a good speech for the person who's giving it. A good speech should be the best possible voice of the person who's giving it, not having everybody sound like John F. Kennedy or Cicero or Demosthenes or something, but sound like their own best voice. And I think that was Joe Biden's best voice. And it was, I think it, on the one hand, I think it was very plain spoken. It was very simple American language, like what Harry Truman or Gerald Ford might have said, but it was also very eloquent. It was as eloquent, I think, in its own way as John Kennedy or Franklin Roosevelt or Barack Obama, because it was his own voice. And it was him talking, not just in his own voice, but talking about the real experience of real Americans whom he's met, a lot of whom are workers and union members. I think it's the first time that a president got up and talked about and quoted a nurse, talked about teachers getting vaccinated, talked about school bus drivers getting vaccinated, talked about school lunch workers getting vaccinated. Gave a shout out, not just to electrical workers, but gave a shout out by name to the IBEW. So he was talking about everyday Americans' experience, but he was doing it with a kind of lift that came from some heartfelt identification with their daily struggles.
Yeah, I look at the reaction from some on the left, and I had to remember back to during the primary when Biden won South Carolina, and a lot of my left friends were, you know, crying in their almond milk that, you know, oh, he's not going to be progressive enough, he's not going to be visionary enough, he's not going to do enough to move the country. And I think, surprisingly, I think a lot of those people today are going, hey, he's risen to the moment.
I think that's right. I think he really is. I mean, it sounds almost like a cliche, but he's the man for this moment, in the sense that he's not threatening. He knows his way around. He doesn't look like someone who's a bomb thrower, but he's really more progressive than any president since, in what he's actually trying to do, than any president since Lyndon Johnson or FDR. He's the first president since FDR, even before last night's speech, to specifically endorse workers' rights to organize and form unions and bargain with their employers. You know, like Roosevelt legendarily did, that was before a long time, but he legendarily did that when he said that if he was a worker, he would join a union. And Joe Biden said the same thing during the Amazon campaign, which he must have known was a very uphill against the odds effort. And I think that's a good measure of what kind of person he is and what kind of president he is.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of memorable lines in it. And, you know, he hits the same one a lot that I think is important to hit on, that, you know, workers built the middle class, built the country, and the middle class was built by unions.
That's right. That's right. And I think part of what is so good about his speeches as president is he's echoing what he said during the campaign. That I think he used that line very early when he was running for president in the primaries. And people probably figured anyone's running for president in a Democratic primary, they're going to say they're pro-union. But then he was the first president in history to say the same thing at a joint session of the United States Congress. And I think whether it's Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama or my old boss, Bill Clinton, who made a point of telling us that he wanted to refer back as president to what he had talked about in the campaign. If you sound the same notes, if you say some of the same things as president in front in the U.S. Capitol that you said it in a living room in Iowa, people think you're for real.
And I'm glad he's done that. Because look, I voted for Bill Clinton for the sole reason he was going to bring strike replacement to happen. That didn't happen. I voted for Barack Obama because he shook my hand twice, told me we were going to get something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. We got none of that stuff. And I remember, you know, as a kid, you know, during the Carter years, they were talking about doing some repeal, half repeal of Taft-Hartley. That didn't get done. But here we are in this moment, and you're someone who's been around labor for a while and politics for a while. It's one thing to talk about it. It's one thing to run on it. Now, as you've pointed out, in the office, he's still talking about it. But what are the chances of actually getting this through? Because ultimately, rhetoric one thing, talking about it another, but actually getting something through on this, something completely different. What do you think the chances of getting anything
done?
Well,
I think this time the administration and the labor movement and progressives around the country are really making a fight of it. I think they were all in the presidents you mentioned were all good presidents and they all meant well. But I think some of what was done was pro forma, that they never really pulled out the stops. You look at some of the presidents you mentioned, and you look at how senators and House members from their own home states voted on some of these issues. And they didn't vote right. And you just had the sense this was not an issue where previous Democratic presidents were pulling out the stops. And you can't really blame them, because for them to pull out the stops, the labor movement has to pull out the stops, and its allies have to pull out the stops. And rank and file people around the country, union members and non-members and progressives, have to say this matters to us. And I think that's going on now. Even with the limits of the pandemic and what remains of social distancing and the emphasis on digital organizing rather than in-person, door-to-door
right.
organizing. But I think it's really, you look at the way that people are putting pressure on the senators from, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, and the Democratic senators from Virginia, you know, just go state by state, there's a real effort going on there.
Well, because there's a lot of us who view this is almost the end of the rope.
That's right.
If something doesn't break soon, there's going to be nothing left to save on the other side. Because in the private sector, we're almost at the union density in this country that it was when it was illegal to be a union member.
That's right.
And people were meeting under the railroad bridge at midnight to hold their meetings. We're at that kind of desperate moment.
That's right. I mean, it's what's it, 6% or something in the private like that?
6.2%, something like that.
That's incredible.
Now, you know, this is one of those moments that, again, you know, we want to talk about the actions of old. And you've actually written a book, I Love the Work, Hate the Job, about the Boeing strike in 2000, of which, you know, we had covered a good portion of that. I think 2008 when they went on strike again under the No Birds, No Nerds, No Birds banner.
That's right. I think they used that slogan first in 2000.
Okay, so I remember it in 2008.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it was a great slogan.
A great slogan. Rick Goforth and the folks over at SPIA did a great job of getting that out. But, you know, again, it just shows that those kind of fights of the past, we're you know, kind of memorializing. But those are the fights of the future. We've got to remember what
right.
they were and figure out how we refight the battles of yesteryear almost.
The Boeing engineer's strike is really a piece of history that needs to be remembered much more than it is. I think it was and still is the largest strike by professional and technical workers in the private sector at any time in American history. Boeing then was the nation's leading manufacturing exporter. It was what I think Bob Reich calls a national champion. It was like, well, one of the most respected companies in the country, and to the extent that the trade deficit wasn't even worse than it, it is. It was because of Boeing. And they blew the whistle in their own way on a lot of the problems that have happened at Boeing since then. They understandably, they didn't want to come out and say the planes aren't safe, but they talked about cutting corners on quality, cutting corners on tests, cutting corners on respect for the engineers and technicians and listening to them. And if someone goes back to what the engineers and technicians were saying in 2000, it's like a prophecy of everything that's happened at Boeing since then.
No, and this is where I come back to, as a union guy, that every working person should have the empowerment that comes with a union, the ability to speak out, because it ultimately, you know, and I would argue, you know, it ultimately saves the company by having employees who are empowered to say, no, I'm not going
That's
to
right.
do something stupid or illegal or I'm not going to cut a corner. I think that there's that check and balance that comes with it that I think is really important.
That's exactly right. I mean, they had many great lines. The no nerds, no birds was a great line. Another great line that they had was they said, we're going to cooperate with Boeing whether they want to or not. and they had the best line of all. I'm sorry for forgetting it. They had the best line of all. They had a picket sign which said on strike for Boeing. Meaning that they can, you know, that the workers considered themselves to be Boeing, not the large shareholders and not the top executives, but the people who designed and did the blueprints and built the planes were Boeing. And they were concerned about, with good reason, as it turned out, about what was happening with Boeing.
And now you've got the company that's kind of split between coasts and, you know, now they're half unionized, you know, it's a mess. Yeah. And again, this is one of those times that organizing has to happen to bring some say back to this. And I think the reason I bring that up is, you know, we're moving into this era of we've been moved in this era where people view themselves as professionals and unions are seen as, well, you know, for those dirty coal miners and those dirty, you know, steel workers and the truck drivers. That's what unions are for. And you go, no, it's for engineers. It's for the workers at Microsoft or Google or Alphabet or any of these tech workers, because you hear the horror stories that come out from them. And I think we lose a lot of the stories from those folks, but they're treated just as poorly.
Exactly. I mean, if there's, I hate to say if there's any silver lining in the current condition of where the labor movement, you know, finds itself, no fault of its own. But there's a revival, especially even like new activity among a new generation of professional and technical and IT workers. That there's, I think there may, even if you factor in the public sector, there may be a higher percentage of union density in professional and technical jobs, certainly if you include teachers and nurses, than in some, you know, production jobs.
No, that's true. And
you know, that's the good news. The bad news is unions should be for everybody who needs a voice and a raise, not to, you know.
No, I'm with you. And the thing is, you know, I look at today, Marty Walsh, the new labor secretary, who I like a lot, came out and talked about gig employees. Sadly, what's happened, especially to professionals, is they've been pushed into this world of, now you're a gig employee. You're no longer an employee, so you can't unionize, but you're your own boss now. And they're talking about, you know, within the next couple of years, upwards of half of all jobs being gig kind of jobs. This is a battle that has to be fought now before it gets even further out of hand.
That's another thing that, I mean, it's been a long time coming, a long time brewing. I wrote, I Love the Work, Hate the Job came out in 2008. It was about an events in and around Seattle, Washington in 2000, you know, the first year of a new millennium. And that was back when people talked about a new economy and talked about Seattle as being the gateway to the new economy. And the point I tried to make was that if that's the new economy, we got some trouble, folks, because workers in Seattle and the new and high-scale, high-tech sectors. I wrote about Boeing, Microsoft, nurses and hospitals there, and there's a kind of a comparison with what the workplace used to be at its best. Now, understanding that's a, you know, a terribly difficult job, but they had a very humane boss. I wrote about the Kaiser Aluminum Company, which had been founded by Henry Kaiser, who was sort of the model of the Enlightened progressive capitalist of the mid-20th century, and what happened to that company after he died and his heirs lost control over it. And there was a lockout. But anyhow, I'm being a little long-winded, but anyhow, in Microsoft during the 1990s, that was sort of a preview of what's happened to tech workers elsewhere.
Right.
Out of 20, I think the figure was out of 20,000 tech workers at Microsoft in the Seattle area in the 90s, 6,000 of them were temp workers. But they weren't really temp workers. I mean, they weren't like hired for 3 months and then let go and they go off and join a grunge band or write a novel or go to law school or medical school. They kept on being rehired as temp workers.
Yeah, they were full-time
and they were paid by what they called employment agencies, staffing agencies, rather than by Microsoft. And they called themselves the permatemps because they were, you know, permanent temporary workers. And they founded an organization called WASHTEC, Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, with CWA. And the bad news was it was a very difficult group to organize. And as Amazon threatened to do, in a few places where they won a unit, Microsoft just shut down the unit. The good news was they got a lot of visibility for their issues. They got a core of people who are still active in unionism today. And they changed a lot of the conditions through the Washington state legislature for the temporary workers. So while things aren't great now, they're better than they were.
Yeah.
And that's sort of both a forerunner and a kind of a model for the condition of tech and temporary workers today and for how they can.
Something's got to happen. Now, I lived through the era of the 90s and the 2000s when you had all these temp agencies and these third-party logistics companies who, if you tried to organize, they just fired them and brought in another one. We definitely have to do something and soon, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the administration does. Before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on you co-authored a book, America Needs a Raise, with John Sweeney, who just passed here in the not-too-distant past. I wanted to get your thoughts on Sweeney and his legacy.
I really think he was both a good man and a great man. And part of his goodness and greatness was I've never worked with anybody at that level of influence in society who had less ego and less affect about himself than John Sweeney. He was just about getting things done. You know, the old saying that's a cliche with most people is really true with him, that he didn't care who got the credit, much less if he got the credit, as long as things got done. And I think his legacy is at least as much the Service Employees Union, SEIU, as it is the AFL-CIO, because at SEIU, he really was able to take a longstanding, very decentralized, very uneven union and turn it into a very effective organizing union and a union that just reached out to everyone who had been overlooked and underpaid in society, immigrants, women, communities of color, people in low-wage service jobs, janitors, hospital workers.
Yeah. I agree. His legacy.
That's really his legacy.
Yep, I agree. His legacy really was SEIU, not the AFL, because I think the AFL has been a mess for a very long time. And we'll see where that takes us. But again, it's been the decline of the movement as a whole because how bad our labor laws have been allowed to be slashed and burned, and the ossification of bad decision after bad decision.
Can I just tell one John Sweeney story?
Sure.
Which didn't even make it into its, into, I don't think it made it into his obituaries. It was in the book. His first job, he told the story on himself, and it's just about, you know, just the interaction of the old economy and a new economy that wasn't going to come around for decades after the story about him. His first job after college was working for IBM. And he was a research economist for IBM. And they asked him, they had like everyone who went to work for them as an economist had to do some kind of, you know, almost academic kind of study. And they asked him to, and this is in the early 1950s, they asked him, mid-1950s, to investigate the possibility of building a small computer, whether there would be a market for such a thing. At that time, computers took up a whole room and, you know, they did a fraction of what your cell phone can do now. And Sweeney dutifully, as he told the story himself, he dutifully went out and investigated it. And he came back And he said he really didn't see that happening, about the only thing he thought it could do was maybe do payrolls for smaller companies. And shortly after that, he went directly out to the old Ladies Garment Workers Union and then for SEIU. That was John Sweeney's brush with corporate America. But he could have been Steve Jobs.
Could have been. But he didn't think the small computer was going to amount to much. I don't know that it had been Steve Jobs.
In fairness, no one else did back then either.
That's true. Good point. But David, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking some time and sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you.
Good
stuff.
Take
care.
David Kuznet. Make sure you check out his work, davidkuznet.com, the website. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day 8,000 UAW workers at the Alice Chalmers plant in Milwaukee voted overwhelmingly to walk off the job. Close to 12,000 production and maintenance workers were on strike across the country. Workers rode the post-war strike wave as whole industries moved to peacetime reconversion. Historian Eric Fur Slocum notes that UAW Local 248 had a historically militant left-wing leadership, was known for its support to housing desegregation campaigns in the city, and was a central driving force of Milwaukee's CIO Council. They had built a strong shop steward and grievance structure at Alice Chalmers and were sure victory was certain. Local President Robert Busey insisted wage increases were not at issue, but rather unresolved issues remained to be settled now that the war was finally over. Key points of contention were the company's demands to eliminate maintenance of membership agreements that guaranteed the closed shop and union dues. The company also wanted to stop paying stewards for the time involved in grievance procedures. The Alice Chalmers strike was a harbinger of things to come. Historian Martin Halpern states that the company officials played a significant role in the crafting of Taft-Hartley legislation as the strike unfolded. Alice Chalmers was on a union-busting campaign and made no small effort to red-bait union leaders for months in local newspapers. By the fall, workers at the smaller plants had returned to work, but the Milwaukee local stood firm. Area CIO workers joined picket lines in support, only to be brutalized and arrested. The House Un-American Activities Committee arrived in town to investigate the strike, and the company instigated a vigorous back-to-work campaign. After 11 months, the strike was called off with no contract and 91 union leaders fired.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, the reality is I hope there is what a lot of people think, that there's going to be an uprising of working people saying enough already. And, you know, I've been talking about this for a while, the idea that we may negotiate everything in our daily life. We negotiate with our spouses, we negotiate with the kids, we negotiate with the person at the stop sign. I got here first, you got here first, no, you go, no. We're always in a constant state of negotiation, trying to just make it through the day. Yet the only place that we don't do that is in the workplace. And I think people, you know, especially the younger generation, they're not going to take it or leave it. They're going to want to make it better. And I think this is a good time. I think the pandemic has opened some eyes, at least I hope. I think the fact that we've had an economy that has created, a handful of extraordinarily wealthy people, while we still can't figure out how to get kids through college without massive debt. And the dropout rates, because of inability to pay, are just astronomical. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, here in Pennsylvania where I'm at, cutting down the number of state universities because, enrollment has dropped. And you go, that's insane. It's insane that you'd be cutting the number of universities as the population of the country continues to grow and as the need for an educated workforce is even more important. These schools are closed down because people don't have the money. And now they're, you know, people are reevaluating. Is it worth going to college, taking on this massive, this enormous expense, and there being no job on the other side? You know, this is where, as policymakers, this is where, as taxpayers and citizens, we've got to be looking towards people in elected office to go, hey, how do we return to a world where, you know, people get to go to get the skills that they need to get the jobs that are coming around, and not be just massively in debt? And now look, I know people are going to say, well, you know, my generation, we had to do it. And I've said it too. The reason I dropped out of college the second time around was I didn't have the money. It was one of those things where I had the money and no time, or I had time and no money. And you shouldn't have to make that choice. There shouldn't be that kind of desperation. Now, my story was a little bit different. I was basically on my own at 18. My grandfather did probably the best thing he could have done for me, and said, "There's the door. Good luck. Call your grandmother every once in a while." Made me grow up really quickly. Made me take responsibility very, very quickly. And as much as I wanted to go back to school, I just didn't have the money. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I graduated from college. And, you know, it's one of those things that it was one of those things I always wanted to do. Because it was something my mother always wanted. But I go back to those days when I didn't have the money. And it was it's insane. And I took on student loans to go for the years that I went, that I had to then pay back without a degree. It shouldn't be this difficult. It should not be this difficult for families to be able to navigate the waters, to get their kids through school and get them opportunities. It just shouldn't be that difficult. And I look back to it and, you have people go, well, you made it through. Yeah. I made it through because there were still good, solid working class jobs available. There were good, solid union jobs available, and there were a number of them when I started. Those jobs are getting fewer and farther between and harder for people to get, and they aren't paying what they were 30 years ago. Which is why we need to see a growth in the labor movement. We need to see a growth in the number of jobs that are out there. And we need people who are going to push policy that are going to make things easier and better for working class kids to go to college and to get an education. I think that's simple, don't you? I think that's kind of what Joe Biden was talking about last night. Recreating that American dream and the foundation by which people can navigate those waters. That's why I think it was a good speech. I think it would have been a great speech had he cut it about in half. It's just my view again. But I think it was spot on. It was the words that needed to be said. I'd like to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ney, Talk Media News, is going to be here to share some thoughts. Stick around. Right back after this.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The gap between what we are doing and what actually needs to be done is widening by the second.
New climate targets still not enough to close the emissions gap. Republicans' infrastructure proposal about one-fifth the size of Biden's. Plus,
say goodbye to your burgers. In order to help hit the Biden administration's climate goals, a limit of 4 pounds of red meat per year or a single average-sized burger every month.
Fox News forced to admit Biden's climate plans do not ban red meat.
All of those stories And more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A graphic and a script incorrectly implied that it was part of Biden's plan for dealing with climate change. That is not the case.
The Green News Report would like to apologize. We refer to Fox News as news. That is not the case. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, so Fox News spent all weekend long freaking out about Joe Biden canceling meat.
With maximal outrage.
And it turns out it's not true at all.
Nope.
Who could have guessed it?
But we'll have more on that in a moment. So, jobs and clean energy were the central focus of President Joe Biden's two-day virtual climate summit last week, attended by some 40 world leaders, business executives, labor union heads. Biden pledged to cut U.S. emissions 50% by 2030 under the Paris Climate Agreement and reach net zero emissions by 2050, calling climate action an unprecedented opportunity to create millions of jobs transitioning to clean energy.
And canceling meat.
No. Scientists say it's achievable with existing technology, but it'll be a very heavy lift. A new report by Europe's Climate Action Tracker calculates that even with the new, more ambitious pledges announced by the United States and other countries, it is still not enough to meet the Paris targets. And the world is way off track to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, unless countries pick up the pace of emissions cuts.
Uh-oh. Or if they cancel meat.
A different study from the European Commission's Joint Research Center finds that there's also a huge discrepancy between what the world's nations say they emit in greenhouse gases each year versus the amount of emissions that independent organizations have calculated using independent models. The gap is roughly equal to the annual emissions of the United States.
Uh-oh.
The researchers warn that the accounting discrepancy will complicate the already difficult task of pinpointing just how much and how fast nations must cut greenhouse gas pollution. Here in the U.S., congressional Republicans unveiled their own infrastructure counterproposal to Biden's American Jobs Plan. Biden proposes to spend $2.2 trillion over 10 years repairing the nation's infrastructure, upgrading for climate impacts, and shifting to cleaner, safer, renewable energy. Republicans' infrastructure proposal is about one-fifth of that, a little over $560 billion.
And I'm guessing there's nothing in it at all about the climate.
Nope.
But they protect burgers, I hope.
Right-wing media began lying about Biden's climate proposals right off the bat, and it demonstrates the right-wing propaganda cycle. They highlighted a year-old, totally unrelated study that suggests that one way to help reduce emissions would be reducing consumption of red meat. The UK's Daily Mail then baselessly speculated that Biden would ban red meat, and then Fox News and right-wing media ran with that lie so Republicans could denounce the imaginary policy. Fox News did not retract that story for 3 days.
Well, you have to have something to be angry about if you're Fox News or Republican.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is moving quickly. The Environmental Protection Agency and the Transportation Department have both rescinded a Trump-era attempt to strip the state of California of its special authority to set its own vehicle tailpipe emissions and pollution standards. Both agencies announced Monday they will restore California's right to set climate limits on cars and SUVs, which many car makers, like General Motors, have already announced that they're going to shift to all-electric vehicles by 2035.
Oh, how nice of them. Instead of Republicans trying to use big government to leverage against small states, the Biden administration is actually letting states do what they please when it comes to limiting carbon emissions.
Finally, Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg testified to the House Oversight Committee on Earth Day. With her characteristic bluntness, Thunberg correctly criticized the pledges made by countries so far as insufficient and delivered a stark warning to those who would delay action.
You still have time to do the right thing and to save your legacies. But that window of time is not going to last for long. We, the young people, are the ones who are going to write about you in the history books. We are the ones who get to decide how you will be remembered. So my advice for you is to choose wisely.
Oh, man. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Choose wisely. This has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Greta. Yeah. See, you seem to think these soulless people have any concern about their legacy. I wish they did. And look, I love that twist from Greta Thunberg there. We're the ones who are going to write about you when you're dead. So do the right thing. I kind of like that. Good on her. So here to share some thoughts on the big speech last night. Talk a little bit about where we go from here, the first 100 days and beyond. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. It's always the famous 100 days, isn't it?
Yep, the 100 days and going back and doing the scoring.
Right. Now Biden and everybody else. It's always a big judgment call in the first 100 days, you know, and people have asked me, I know in the last 3 weeks, well, you know, don't you think Biden is doing, as president, just doing too much of this and too much of that? And I said, well, you've got the first 100 days, and he wants to put an agenda in, and then you see the rest of the year how you make it work. You kind of throw it out there the first 100 days.
Yep. Now, the people who keep score on the promises made during the campaign, of which they say there were 61 promises, they say he has already kept 26 of them. 32 more have been partially kept, and only 3 of the promises that he made during the campaign he hasn't started. So to highlight your point, the vast majority of what he ran on, he's already touching.
Right, and yeah, because that was the question, of course, today, you know, of the promises he's made. He had, the 200 million shots, right? That was a biggie. They had the reopen schools. He had promised, to do that from the federal level. And then the mask mandate, I'm trying to remember, too. Oh, the relief package, of course. That's, you know, number one and really big aspect of it. And then he's got the reversing the Trump tax cuts. And that's not done, but it's
in the works.
Progress, yeah. And then environmental actions, the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Accord, the XL permit, which, you know, that's kind of controversial, but he still, you know, did it. The troops from Afghanistan, which with interest I saw where Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton were kind of in sync saying, you know, don't do this too fast. Well, he's taking till September, so I kind of thought that was, you know, interesting. Oh, we rejoined the World Health Organization. That is a biggie. And then citizenship to executive orders he has accomplished. So most of everything I just, you know, spouted off about here and a list of things was done without actually congressional action except for the stimulus package. So he was able to do it through executive orders or through the government itself.
Yeah, he got the easy stuff done, the stuff that he could sign off with a pen. Now it's the heavy lifting. It's
right.
It's getting some work done. But today, you got a water infrastructure bill pushed through 89-2 through the Senate. Mm-hmm. Pretty surprised right. with that.
That's pretty good. I mean, right after, you know, State of the Union, maybe it's a honeymoon period and they can, you know, do a few other things. See where it goes.
Yeah. And now today, I understand the White House has unveiled an aid package to India. We're going to send some oxygen. We're going to send some masks. We're going to send some material to help them. I guess $100 million in aid and a bunch of supplies, some 20 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, 1 million rapid diagnostic tests, as much this Remdesivir as we can give them. This is a start, right?
Right, and basically we're also returning a favor for what they did for us, you know, last year when we needed some help and some medicine, and, you know, they had sent it from India. And I think the biggest thing this does, though, with what the president's doing is it's going to activate other nations, you know, to help. And again, any nation that's lagging behind like India or Africa, we can sit there and say, well, the prime minister should have done this and they should have done that. The bottom line remains a lot of these countries that are third world need help, and the world's going to help them because we're all in this together.
Yep.
You can't have all of us better, and then it still lags behind anywhere else in the world.
And this again gives us the ability to reassert our position in the world that I think we've for 4 years let go void, because I don't want China being the one to fill that void.
And they will. I mean, they have. They have consistently done that where we have failed or not wanted to act, or we've been very protectionist, you know, internally here with issues, and China, you know, tends to always step in. And I think you make a great point, Rick. It is a leadership that we're reengaging throughout the world. And I don't think you're going to see, seriously, this week, the ability of anybody, you know, from the right to step in and say, well, he's hurting Americans. He's reached his goal in continuing when it comes to the supplies we need, so therefore we can share. And I think he will have very, very little criticism.
No, and there should be no criticism here because we've got enough. We've got enough. I've heard no stories of people saying, I can't get it. We're now moving. Everybody should be able to get vaccinated. And in fact, we're in the position where, you know, I saw today New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said by July 1st, New York City is going to be wide open. It's going to be, you know, back to the way it was before the pandemic, or at least that's what he seems to believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, with caution, we will begin to go back to, you know, certain things and with caution throughout the summer. And if more people are vaccinated, then it should, you know, maybe not be completely normal, but it'll be fairly normal compared to what we've had.
Some good news, the economy bouncing back. And again, I think this has a lot to do with the rescue plan, has a lot to do with confidence, has a lot to do with, you know, things just kind of slowly getting back to some bit of normalcy. But, you know, 6.4% rebound in the economy in the first quarter of the year. I think that's pretty impressive, no?
Well, it is. And I think what we're going to see is a great growth. The predictions for 2021 of the gross domestic product, which is our measure of goods and services, as you say, I mean, it's going to be up. And as long as that happens, and as long as people are returning to the job market, I think it's going to be, it's going to be a great thing. Housing is on fire. You know, I do flip houses, and my house that I put up on the market was up for 2 hours.
Wow.
Before, yeah, 2 hours. And I was given $10,000 over what I asked for the house. So I think, obviously the housing, because of low interest rates, is continuing to boom. Now, of course, the contractors can come in and can overbuild, don't get me wrong. But I think in general, the housing market's very, very strong. And you've seen Janet Yellen, who is our treasurer, of course, has made some statements which are tending to go towards keeping those interest rates low at this period of time. Not that she can control it, but her voice obviously is important in the process.
You sold it in 2 hours. Why didn't you wait four?
Well, actually, I kept it open, as I promised, for 3 days. When I say I sold it in 2 hours, 2 hours after I put it up is the offer that I eventually took, I took. But I kept it open, and I ended up with 9 offers on it.
Wow.
So it was the best one when I rated what type of loan and type of terms and things like that. Now, the problem, in fact, if anybody out there that's listening is doing flipping, they know, try to find a house. That's the problem. They're tough to find.
No, they are. Trust me, we're just in the process of buying my daughter a house. And,
mm-hmm.
and right now the stock is low, which is surprising to me. And when something does pop up on the market, it goes really quickly.
Right. My house went up on the market in Little Newark, Ohio. I was one of 4 new houses, 4 in an area of 58,000 people.
Now, I don't think people are selling because, like you said, you're going to have to go and buy. So you might get a lot for what you have, but then you got to go out and find something else.
Exactly. But the good news is the housing market is going pretty strong. A lot of the moratorium was placed into effect by the Biden administration. That helped a lot for people to be able to stay in their apartments, So overall, I think the potential crisis that could have been out of there. Can you imagine if people could have just been evicted everywhere?
Yeah.
I think the policies helped through a bad pandemic.
No, I mean, what happens when the moratorium slows down, goes away, and people are still going to be behind on their mortgages? Because I'm reading reports out there, there are still millions of people who are still behind. The $1,400 helped. But if you didn't have a paycheck for 6 months and you didn't pay your rent for 4 or 6 months or your mortgage, you're behind. You know, what happens to those folks?
Well, that's right. I mean, they have to be careful because when the moratorium happened, you still pay portions of rent, or when it expires, of course, then you have the problem of what do you do. And I would think at some point in time, somebody's going to craft an executive order that graduates payment in. In other words, yeah, I understand the landlord has to have payment, but they could graduate in that you are lifting the moratorium, but effectively you're saying stagger in with normal payments people are making for rent, stagger in back rent over a period of time that works for the person to be able to keep, the apartment they have.
Yeah,
something like that may be a brainchild of the administration that would at least help, to bridge the gap.
Yeah, because one of the things I'm worried about is, here we get down the road a little bit, and we've bought this house at what I think is a pretty high point, and then you're going to have a whole bunch of foreclosures, and the market's just going to collapse around it.
Well, I mean, that's potentially possible, and then I think there's another aspect we have to look at. Again, you get a lot of landlords saying, well, wait a minute, I have to eat too and pay bills, and that's understandable, except they were receiving their rent payments, right? And then the people, through some of them, through federal subsidy programs, through the programs that were instituted through the stimulus. So those landlords got taxpayers' money to keep things going, or they got loans that are going to be forgiven because they're self-employed entities. And I think that's got to be taken in consideration. You just can't take that money and then say, well, now I'm going to throw you out.
Yeah, no, I hope that to be the case.
I hope.
Also wanted to get your thoughts on, evidently there was an energy attack near the White House. What was that about? Do you know?
Energy attack?
Yeah, it says the U.S. reportedly investigating a potential energy attack. National Security Council reported near the south side of the White House in November of 2020. Evidently there was some kind of energy attack.
That must be... that must be an attack similar to what happened down in the embassy in Cuba.
Yes.
Because that sounds exactly like what in the mysterious attack down there that caused then some problems within, with people in their brains down there. It sounds like the same very thing that happened overseas in Cuba.
Yeah, it's saying, people are left with debilitating symptoms. And the reason I ask is, I have a friend whose father's having some issues, and I'm going, is it possible that this is part of all that? I thought maybe you'd have some thoughts.
No, the only thing I can say that at first when this happened down in Cuba, this very same type of thing, they're kind of pinpointed. They're not in general all over the city. They're in specific areas like they were in the embassy in our mission at that time in Cuba. And they at first thought it was a mass hysteria. One person has something and the rest assume or imagine they have, but it wasn't that. I mean, it was tested and proven that something, they don't know what, caused these really bad debilitating symptoms in a lot of people's situations down there. This might be the very same thing.
Yeah, something like a microwave attack is what they were saying.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Things are getting crazier.
These days, it's easy to imagine that it can be done. And again, if it's just a certain energy attack near the White House only, it wasn't citywide, so it was something obviously that was aimed at
it was targeted.
Certain place.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I wanted to get your thoughts again on any new information on Rudy and the seizures of electronic devices from his apartment and his office. Now, especially that you've got this ex-lawmaker from Ukraine speaking out, or evidently speaking to the FBI.
Yes, and did you happen to see Rudy's son by chance?
I didn't.
No. Oh, okay. Well, later on, you have to look this one up. He came out to the crowd all of a sudden And then he proceeded to talk, which was not impressive. And then he proceeded to blame, this was the great thing he said. He said, they took everything from my father's office, but the one thing that would incriminate the president's son, not Trump, President Biden, the president's son, you know, Hunter Biden, this is the one thing. They didn't take that, and then he left. It was just quite amazing. But Rudy Giuliani is going to argue now, and this is very interesting because we have to remember Cohen, the president's lawyer, President Trump's lawyer, argued this. He's going to argue, of course, of privilege. He's the president's attorney. He was working for the president on this. Well, the fact remains that, first of all, he wasn't a White House employee. Two, he was the president's attorney, but was the president asking him to work on issues with the Ukraine and dirt on the Bidens? Is that an official function for the attorney? Cohen tried in court to get his subpoenaed records. He tried to get them thrown out, and they were only narrowly released on a certain narrow portion of what he asked. So I think if you look at that precedence, because he was the president's attorney, Cohen was, Rudy Giuliani is not going to be successful in federal court of getting all of those documents thrown out. He may have some narrow issues in there, but just as Cohen, he's not going to be successful in hiding behind the fact that he was, quote, the president's attorney, because, again, how could he be the president's attorney on dealing with Ukraine partners and dealing with information from the Ukraine on a political campaign?
Yeah.
That's not White House privilege.
No, it's not. And
correct.
My mind keeps going to the idea that, client attorney privilege only matters if you're not part of the crime.
Well, that's the other thing. You hit the nail on the head. If Donald Trump had sat down and told Rudy Giuliani some information about personal knowledge he had with the Ukraine, with Biden, et cetera, that's one issue. But when it's the lawyer themselves doing it, then you don't say, well, I can't be looked at because I did it for my client. That's not the client telling the attorney something. That's the attorney acting on his own nefariously. I don't see where, Rick, he wins this in a broad basis to have the information thrown out. And if he doesn't win that in a broad basis, I think he's in trouble.
Yeah, I don't either. Now I was wondering why I saw Chris Farley trending on Twitter. And it was the clip of him playing Giuliani's son during one of the campaigns. that was so funny.
Oh, you'll get a charge out of the he just kind of appeared out of nowhere, spouted off a little bit and said they should have got the one thing, the information on the president's son, and then he left.
Yeah, no, I'm not seeing it. That's pretty funny.
Right.
I did want to bring up one thing. We have a listener who sent a video of you talking with the Young Turks back in 2016 about Bernie Sanders.
Oh, yes.
And wanted to hear your thoughts on Bernie. So,
right.
Real quick, you got a thought on Bernie?
Well, sure. In fact, that clip made them some money. It went fairly viral, I think, to 150,000 some. I was at the convention, Democratic convention, and they asked me about Trump versus Clinton, and I said, there's some hesitation. They said, Sanders. I said, sure, that's a given. And they felt that, they seized on it to say that Sanders would have been a clearer choice. And the reason I said that, that Sanders was a clearer choice, and my friends have scoffed at me on this, but Sanders and Trump were basically, let's say, fairly identical on trade, all right? Hillary wasn't. She was suspicioned by a lot of people that she would make these trades the gold standard and that she would not support working people. And the bottom line is, I argue that, yes, Bernie might have been, quote, to the left, as people say, but how would Bernie Sanders, let me ask this, have done in Pennsylvania against Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania with working people against Donald Trump?
No, I think in 16, Bernie would have won.
That was exactly what I said, and that clip got a lot of hits because that's what I said. It was pretty clear cut on Bernie Sanders, but not clear-cut on Hillary versus Donald Trump, you know, who I and other people would support.
Yeah. No, I think in 16, Sanders would have won. I think he'd have gotten crushed in 20.
Yes, true. That's true.
That's just
different
my thought.
Time.
And I'm a Sanders guy. I still was going to vote for him. But I, you know, in looking at it, that's how I saw it. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you because somebody threw that clip out and a big fan of yours. So just wanted to throw that out. But as always, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend, Bob Ney. I think, and I don't like that. I don't like the fact that that Bernie would have lost in 2020, I think. But I just think that's the way it was. And this is, judging, from the speech last night, I'm not upset with who the American people chose to be president. And for my Republican listeners who are still saying that they cheated, still no proof. And there, I guess there are no more court challenges. You've lost all of those in what are fairly packed Republican courts. So there that goes. The speech again, is a good starting point forward. From this point forward, it's about jobs. The fact that the president brought up jobs 46 times, I think that is I think that's an indication of where the mindset is going to go and where we're going to be spending the coming weeks talking about how we rebuild our economy. Lots of stuff to get to. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me at rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Oh, great. Here comes a new stealth attack on the fragile, life-sustaining natural resources of planet Earth. This assault is by Wall Street alchemists who are out to redefine one of our most basic resources, water. Everyone knows that water is invaluable. It's literally life, requiring a constant intake by each of us, or we quickly die. But the wizards of Wall Street want to reduce potable H2O from its environmental, humanitarian, and spiritual essence to just another perishable economic good that they can market price and sell to the highest bidder. Literally turning our water into speculators' gold. This contrivance has opened the door for financial manipulators who've quietly been devising razzle-dazzle schemes to allow rich global investors to play in water. They're now pushing water futures, automated split-second trading, water-grabbing ventures, hedging schemes, and other financialization hustles to maneuver the monetary value of this essential resource. To see this ethically debased future, look to an outfit with the ominous acronym of WAM, Water Asset Management. It's buying up water rights in low-income farming communities in places like Arizona, then literally moving the commodity to rich suburban developments that will pay more. WAM profiteers call water peddling a trillion-dollar market opportunity. They even boast that the devastation caused by climate change creates a market volatility that will provide an unprecedented period of transformation and investment opportunity for the water industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's begin to force a public discussion about this crucial question of environmental and existential ethics. Is access to an affordable supply of clean water to be a human right for all? Or will we let it become a wet dream for a cabal of rich speculators? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.